From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Patti Smith is performing and recording again after a long hiatus. She left the music scene to raise a family and has returned a couple of years after the death of her husband. On today's Fresh Air, Patti Smith returns to our show to talk about her life and about her new CD. Many of the songs deal with loss. In the past few years, Patti Smith also lost her brother and her close friend, the artist Robert Mapplethorpe. Also, TV critic David Bianculli reviews the final work of Dennis Potter, who wrote the British TV series The Singing Detective and Pennies from Heaven. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. In a major victory for the Justice Department, the Supreme Court has ruled that the government may seize the property of drug defendants as well as prosecute them for criminal violations. The justices overturned lower court rulings that had barred the government from using civil forfeitures along with criminal prosecutions. The lower courts had ruled that such twin actions violated the constitutional ban on double jeopardy. The High Court disagreed. The Supreme Court has also agreed to decide if a sexual harassment lawsuit against President Clinton should be delayed as long as he's in office. The decision puts the claim by former Arkansas State employee Paula Jones on hold until after the election this fall. No ruling is expected until next year. A federal jury in Philadelphia will try again today to reach a full verdict in the trial of former top city officials charged with using excessive force in the 1985 police bombing of the radical group MOVE. From WHYY in Philadelphia, NPR's Eric Westervelt reports.
Defendants in the case are the City of Philadelphia and its former police and fire commissioners. All are charged with using unreasonable force in dropping a bomb on MOVE's fortified headquarters, which killed 11 MOVE members and leveled more than 60 homes in the worst residential fire in city history. Late Friday, the jury, looking weary after 8 days of deliberations, said they had reached an undisclosed verdict against one defendant, but were deadlocked on the other two. Federal Judge Lewis Pollack then implored the jury to keep trying. MOVE attorney Finn Court Shelton says he's not pleased with the possibility of a hung jury.
I don't know, and I would hate to think about trying this case again.
Frustrated?
No, I'm not frustrated, but I've spent my whole spring trying a case, and I want a verdict.
The jury is down to 7 members today after one juror told the judge he couldn't take it anymore and was dismissed. This is Eric Westervelt in Philadelphia.
Hundreds of people in northern Arizona are being kept away from their homes after a weekend wildfire forced officials to evacuate hundreds of residents. Patty Urias, a member station KNAU, reports.
A total of 10 blazes continue to burn in the Coconino and Kaibab National Forests of Arizona. For a time, one of the fires forced the closure of U.S. Highway 180, one of the main routes to the Grand Canyon. Coconino National Forest spokeswoman Raquel Romero says containing that fire has been difficult because fire personnel have had to contend with high winds of up to 60 miles per hour over the weekend.
When the winds get that high, we are not able to use air support. We had to ground some air tankers at some points because as they drop fire retardant in those strong of winds, it doesn't do much good. The fire retardant just tends to dissipate.
Nearly 25,000 acres have been scorched so far. For National Public Radio, I'm Patty Urias in Flagstaff.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 31 points, the Nasdaq Composite up 6. This is NPR News. Nabisco has announced plans to cut 4,200 jobs in a restructuring aimed at saving the subsidiary of RJR Nabisco up to $200 million a year. The cuts amount to an 8% reduction in workforce. About half of the layoffs will come in the U.S. A senior U.S. official says North Korea is in urgent need of more food aid and heavy construction equipment to avoid a new disaster in the coming rainy season. The communist country is still reeling from the effects of devastating floods last year. China has ordered its army and political cadres to study a recent warning by President Jiang Zemin. In a speech linked to the upcoming 75th anniversary of the founding of the Communist Party in China, Zhang said continued corruption and political mistakes could cause the party's downfall. NPR's Mary Kay Magstad reports.
For years, China's Communist Party has been trying to balance old socialist ideology with new free market realities. especially of concern has been rampant corruption among party and military officials, which the party knows is causing it to lose respect. President Jiang Zemin has said that such mistakes could also cause the party to lose power, and that China is in dire need of what he called better quality cadres. By this, he said, he meant those who are not corrupt, who have a hunger for professional knowledge and a far-sighted vision for communism. Zheng's speech was part of the lead-up to next Monday's 75th anniversary of the Chinese Communist Party. The political department of the People's Liberation Army has decreed that all 3 million PLA troops should study the speech carefully. I'm Mary Kay Magstad in Hong Kong.
Actor Robert Downey Jr. is facing drug and weapons charges after a traffic stop on the Pacific Coast Highway in California yesterday. Sheriff's deputies say they found cocaine, heroin, and a concealed weapon in Downey's truck. He's also been charged with driving under the influence. I'm Craig Windham, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for Fresh Air comes from Farrar, Straus & Giroux, publishers of Lush Life, a new biography about jazz legend Billy Strayhorn. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Patti Smith is recording and performing again after a long hiatus, and her many fans are thrilled to have her back. She's an icon in the world of rock. The New York Times recently called her the godmother of punk. In the 70s, she created a hybrid of poetry and rock and developed a high-energy performance style that was sometimes aggressive, sometimes ecstatic. Her first album, Horses, was released in 1975. In 1980, she left the music scene to raise a family with her husband, the musician Fred Smith. Outside of an album they collaborated on in 1988, she kept out of the public eye until this year. Many of the songs on her new CD are about loss. Her husband died of heart failure a couple of years ago. Her brother died of a stroke shortly after. Her longtime friend, the artist Robert Mapplethorpe, died in 1989 of AIDS. Patti Smith has a new book of prose pieces dedicated to Mapplethorpe called The Coral Sea. Before we talk about her new CD, Gone Again, let's hear a song from it. This is My Madrigal. Patti Smith from her new CD, Gone Again. Patti Smith, welcome back to Fresh Air. It's a pleasure to have you back.
Thank you.
I think some of the songs on this new CD are really unlike some of the songs you've done in the past, such as the song we just heard, My Madrigal. There's an emotional straightforwardness in this song, and that almost chant quality of Till Death Do Us Part that I just find different from your previous work. Do you feel like you're writing out of a different kind of energy now?
Well, definitely. Well, Horses, a lot of the material in Horses was gleaned from 4 or 5 years' work before it was recorded. So I really started working on the work that came out on Horses when I was about 21 years old. So naturally, a lot of the work encompasses a lot of the anarchistic adolescent energy of a, you know, sort of a late blooming 22-year-old. So, you know, and subsequent records were really involved in, pursuits, artistic pursuits, involved in exploring language, exploring the sonic areas of the electric guitar, exploring the alchemy of live performance with my band members. So I was, and my concerns were different. You know, I was concerned with censorship, with the continuum of rock and roll as being a grassroots art form with global communication. And at this time in my life, my concerns were really a lot more basic. My concerns have to do with survival, pretty much, on Gone Again. And so.
Till Death Do Us Part, I'm assuming, of course, is about the loss of your husband. How long did it take before you started writing songs about his death?
Well, actually, not the first month. I really think I really started writing a little more than a month after he passed away, when my brother passed away. That actually had a different type of effect on me. My brother was the same age as Fred. They were both 45. My brother was a very, very supportive, high-spirited, youthful man. And he loved to see me work. He was, in the last month of his life, trying to help me get back on my feet and encouraging me to get back to work and get back to performing and songwriting. And he said that he would help me. And my brother was once the head of my crew in the Patti Smith Group. And he did encourage me and fill me with a certain amount of energy. So when my brother passed away, all of the energy that he put into me, all of that encouragement, all of that love, I didn't want to go in vain. And so I picked myself up and began to work really hard after my brother passed away.
For many years, for about 16 years, you had basically been at home with your family.
Yes.
Raising your children and, you know, not being on the road, not being in the recording studio outside of one 1988 session that you collaborated on with your husband. After your husband died, did that life no longer make sense to you, the life of being at home and not performing anymore? Did outside of your brother encouraging you to perform again, did you feel in your own heart that it was time to make a change?
Well, no, it wasn't like that. Fred and I had already started work on a new album. We are parents, and we have financial concerns. You know, we have to make a living as well as express ourselves as artists. And, you know, we had a lot of things we wanted to express. Fred wanted to do another rock album. He wanted to do a very globally concerned album. And we also, it was time for us to do some work to, you know, prepare for our children's future, you know, their formal education and things like that. So we had pretty much planned to record and do some minimal touring. So what I have done is just continue on our mutual battle plan.
I want to play another track from your new CD, and this is a song called Fireflies. Would you tell us what you were thinking about when you wrote this?
Well, actually, Fireflies came out of a piece of music written by Oliver Ray, who I've been collaborating with. He also wrote the song Walking Blind, which I performed on the Dead Man Walking soundtrack. And Oliver's also a poet, so he gave me some of the first lines for it. He gave me the 11 steps till I can rest, 11 steps till I'm blessed by you, are Oliver's words. So I took those words and just went on the journey of the song. And I think it's really it's the last one we did. It's like my last wailing, I would think, my last Well, I can't think of it any better than that. But I think when I listen to it now, it seems like a sort of a painful but successful journey of one who didn't want to get out of bed or didn't want to rise to feel life again and to keep going. And I suppose, you know, it's also in some ways a love song for Fred.
This is Fireflies, Patti Smith from her new CD, Gone Again.
Living on steps till I can rest. Living steps till I'm listening by you.
That's Fireflies from Patti Smith's new CD, and Patti Smith is my guest. You know, I think of this in a way as a love poem with some very Christian imagery in it, like, I will wash your feet and dry them with my hair.
Yeah, I've been, if one went through all of my albums, every single one of them, including the first, is littered with Christian imagery, I think. It's because I've been reading the Bible since I was a child and always found it inspiring, not only spiritually but poetically. And I have a tendency to do that. I think I can't think of any piece of work I've done that doesn't have some, at least abstract, allusion to the scriptures.
Now, I know when you were young, you were a Jehovah's Witness for several years. Was that the religion of your parents or something that you joined independently?
My mother's religion. I was a Jehovah's Witness till I was about 12. And in those days, Jehovah's Witnesses were stricter about one's pursuits outside of being a witness. And I decided I wanted to be an artist. I went to the Philadelphia Museum of Art with my father and saw art in person and immediately wanted to become a painter. And my desires sort of collided with their teachings. So I made the choice. I left the Witnesses to become an artist. I think they're a much more benevolent and more understanding group right now. And but at that time, I didn't get any sympathy or encouragement for that kind of way of life. So, my drive to be an artist was extremely strong as a 12 or 13 year old.
And did you try other organized religions, or was that the end of organized religion for you? For some time,
I looked in. I thought of for a while. I wanted to be Jewish, but I think that was my Anne Frank period. I didn't realize that you just can't be, you know, you don't turn Jewish. I had great sympathy. I mean, when I grew up, you know, in the late 50s and early 60s, there was, you know, of course, a lot of information came out about the Holocaust, and there were trials and things, and I felt devastated about that as a young girl, and I got very interested in the Jewish the Jewish faith. But I never really, I think once I left my first organized religion, I found, as I checked each one out, that really wasn't for me. Because I really don't like the idea of exclusion. You know, I think all people, you know, return to God or whatever God is or the energy of God. And I think all manners to get to him, whether it's, you know, through Islam or whether one's a Buddhist or a Christian or a Catholic, or I think they're all beautiful, you know, really.
What's the nature of your faith now? Are you in an organized religion?
Oh, no. No, not at all. I say my prayers and continue my studies. But I basically, for me, I don't really prescribe or need a religion. What's important to me is my communication with what I perceive to be God.
My guest is Patti Smith. She has a new CD called Gone Again. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Patti Smith. Now, what a lot of people might find confusing or paradoxical is, on one hand, this kind of spiritual inclination you've had since childhood and never stopped having, and at the same time, your art is the kind of art a lot of people would describe as blasphemous.
Well, I think blasphemy is just a form of exploring. You know, it's just a, you know, youthful, exuberant manner of exploring the whole concept. I think I've often found the people that are the most blasphemous are often wind up to be the truest believers, because they've taken the time actually to question, pull things apart, be angry, and then either submit or, you know, find certain answers. A lot of people misconstrued, for instance, the statement, Jesus died for somebody's sins but not mine.
Right.
People constantly came up to me and said, you're an atheist, you don't believe in Jesus. And I said, obviously, I believe in him. I've stated, you know, I've made a statement, you know, which, you know, I'm saying that, you know, the concept of Jesus, I believe in. I just wanted the freedom. I wanted to be free of him. I was 20 years old, and when I wrote that, and it was sort of my youthful manifesto. In other words, I didn't want to. I guess I didn't want to be good, you know, and I didn't want to. But I didn't want him to have to worry about me, or I didn't want him taking responsibility for my wrongdoings or my youthful explorations. I wanted to be free. So it's really a statement about freedom.
Well, that line comes up in a couple of places. It opens up your recording of Gloria.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also in a poem that you wrote in the early 70s called Oath.
Yeah, well, that's where it came from.
Yeah.
I wrote it like in 1970 and used it.
In Gloria.
And really it just evolved that way. A lot of the work on horses was not preconceived. It's just I started out as a performing poet, and when Lenny and Richard Soule were working with me, a lot of the poetry began to evolve and merge with music. And so a lot of horses has to do with the chemistry between Lenny, Richard, and I, and how they helped me further evolve my poetry.
Now, when you were young, did you feel set apart from other kids
Definitely.
Your age?
Definitely.
By what?
Everything. Well, I was just physically, I was kind of, I felt sort of like an ugly duckling. I was sort of like skinny and clumsy and not very athletic. I had a lot of guts, though, and I was a fast runner. But I was sick a lot. You know, I had scarlet fever and measles and mumps. I always had something. And a little frail. But I also was the oldest of three children, so I had a lot of responsibility. I don't know, I just generally felt estranged, but not only estranged from the other kids, I felt estranged from the planet. And truthfully, I spent most of my childhood believing that I was adopted by my parents and I was actually an alien.
Like from another planet?
Yeah, I know it sounds fun, but I perceived an alien. I used to have this idea that I was sort of like part of like this alien race that were part Venus and part American Indian. Now, this sounds kind of funny now, but I was very serious about it as a child. I had a whole cosmology and a whole universe formed around these thoughts. But I definitely didn't feel at home on the planet. I felt much more at home when I'd read books about the Aztecs or or if I'd read stories about aliens on other planets, or I didn't really feel like I belonged.
Now, I know your parents didn't have a lot of money, but if you were, say, middle class or like upper middle class.
A lower middle class.
Right. Well, if you were like upper middle class, you probably would have been sent to a psychiatrist for help.
Well, not by my parents. I don't think so. No, I wasn't a child in pain or anything. I was actually proud of my secret of my secret
heritage.
Heritage. No, I wasn't like that. I wasn't a disturbed child. Mm-hmm. I was actually had a happy childhood. I loved my brother and sister. We were inseparable. They thought the world of me, and I found something my brother wrote after he passed away about our childhood, and he talks about how I was like King Arthur and they were the knights in my court. And they always believed in me, and I invented endless games and stories and plays for us to be involved in. And my parents were, my mother was, they were both hardworking, but my mother was always loving and creative, and she just had a lot of magic. I mean, my dad was on strike and we had no food or very little food, you know, she'd like make us like Wonder Bread with butter and sugar. And she'd like tell a story and this would become a great delicacy. We'd pretend we were all hiding out, you know, like hiding out from like the Nazis or something. And we hadn't eaten in 3 days and this was our food. And it was so wonderful. She made everything into a game. And, I had a great, those private thoughts I had were part of my creative energy or mm-hmm. the complexity of my mind. But mm-hmm. I wasn't a disturbed child. I was just a little offbeat, I guess.
Petty Smith has a new CD called Gone Again. She also has a new book of short prose pieces dedicated to her longtime friend, the late artist Robert Mapplethorpe. It's called The Coral Sea. Petty Smith will be back with us in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Patti Smith and talk about her early days as a performer, when she read poetry in bars and had to verbally spar with the audiences to keep the mic. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews British TV writer Dennis Potter's last work.
Oh, to be
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with the second part of our interview with Patti Smith. She left the music scene in 1980 to raise a family. Her husband died a couple of years ago. Now she's performing and recording again. She has a new CD called Gone Again, and Arista Records is reissuing her earlier recordings. Now, you wrote for several years before actually performing in a rock and roll kind of setting and performing with music. When you started putting the two together, did you have any idea that you could sing? Had you used your voice that way before?
No, not really. I mean, I used to daydream when I was a kid about being an opera singer, and I loved Maria Callas, and my mother's a really nice singer. She, you know, had sort of like a 30s-style jazz voice. And my father had a nice voice, but I never thought about singing. I think I sang in the school choir or something, but I didn't really excel or have any real gift. But what I did have, I think, always was I've always, for some reason, been comfortable talking in front of people or performing in front of people. And I guess I got a lot of guts, but I never really had that great a voice. I think it's basically guts.
Well, speaking of guts, when you first started reading, you've said that you were reading, you know, early on, often in bars that weren't places if you'd be likely to hear a poet.
No, they weren't.
What kind of places did you read in before you started
adding
music?
Wherever I could, you know, I wasn't really accepted in the poet clique. I didn't have a lot of respect for poets, and I thought most of the poets, the more academic way of breaking into the poetry circle, it wasn't interesting to me. I didn't really relate to them, and I thought most of the poetry readings I went to were boring, and it just wasn't my scene. So I started pursuing different venues to perform my poetry, and I just read anywhere that anybody would take me, usually for free, just to get the experience, or for $5 or $10. And sometimes I'd be the opening act's opening act. You know? So I'd play like in a bar that had like a little rock band and some little blues band, and I'd go on before the blues band. And, you know, nobody was interested in what I had to say. You know, they weren't interested in hearing poetry, or, you know, they wanted to hear music and they were half drunk or whatever. But I figured they told me I had 15 minutes or 20 minutes on that little stage, that was my stage, and I was going to fight for it. So I usually spent, if I had 20 minutes, 14 minutes arguing that I had the right to be there.
Arguing with the audience?
Yeah, and then finishing with Piss Factory. And which usually I did such a strong reading of it that it would take them off guard and they'd kind of like it. And then I was gone. But
what was the arguing with them like?
Like sparring, you know, like the I can't, you know, like get a job, go in the kitchen where you belong, and you know, I was really good at sparring. I really loved Johnny Carson, and I really studied his whole monologue thing and the way Johnny Carson would go back and forth with the audience, and that was actually more in my mind of what I wanted to do, sort of be like Johnny Carson.
Let me play the first track of your first LP, and this is Gloria. What made you decide to rework this song?
Well, truthfully, it was in the beginning, it was just Lenny and I, and then we brought in a piano player who was Richard Soule. He was quite young, quite gifted. He was actually a classical piano player, but he had a great sense of rhythm. So it was just the three of us, a guitar, piano, and I, and we did very simple songs because the configuration was so simple. And we just chose songs that were basically three chords so I could improvise over them, because I didn't want to just, like, do songs, you know.
Right.
I didn't want to do like lame approximations of songs. So what
Patti
we did
Smith
is,
covers the hits.
we did what we called field work, you know. So we'd pick songs that had basically three chords that I could, like, and just sort of use them as a springboard. I didn't really have any interest in covering Gloria, but it had three chords, and I liked the rhythm, and we just sort of used it for our own design, the same as Land of a Thousand Dances. Land of a Thousand Dances became really like a battleground for all kinds of adolescent excursions. And so that's why we picked songs like that. I remember I wrote the ad copy for our first album, and the ad copy I wrote for Horses was three chords merged with the power of the word.
That's great, yeah.
That was our philosophy.
I was wondering who wrote that, because I thought that was good.
Yeah, it was me. Wrote my own ad. I don't do it anymore, but I used to write my own ads.
Did you feel no one else would know what the right thing
right.
to say?
Yeah, I didn't trust anybody.
Yeah. Oh. Well, this is Gloria from Patti Smith's first LP, Horses. And I should say the LPs on Arista are all getting reissued.
People say beware, but I don't care.
Music from Patti Smith's 1975 album, Horses. She'll be back with us after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Patti Smith. What was it like for you to create yourself on stage, to find out who you were on stage?
Well, I never really felt like I created myself, because I'm the kind of performer that, you know, I roll out of bed, whatever I put on, you know, I roam the streets for a few hours, it's time for the job, and I go to the job. I don't, like, do any special type of thing. You know, I might meditate with my band for a few minutes before we go on, but my task as a performer was the opposite. I always have worked to strip away the idea of a stage persona.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, what happens when I'm on stage is a lot of the different things within me. Of course, because it's such a high intensity situation, are somewhat magnified, you know. So if one has some rage within them, that rage is magnified, but it's the same as if one has benevolence or silliness, you know. So like a night, one of our concerts from the very beginning in 74 till even now is just, you know, an evening of you know, myself and the people. And I always think it's all of our responsibilities to find out, you know, what the night's going to be made of. I'm not really interested in finding, like, out about who I am. I'm more interested in finding how we can best serve the night together.
When you looked at other people in rock, men and women, was there anybody who you particularly felt a kinship to in terms of what they were like on stage and the kind of energy they gave off?
Well, when I was younger, I mean, I never thought that I'd ever be involved in be a performer in the arena of rock and roll. I mean, I was raised, you know, and when I was raised, you know, when you saw females in the music business, they were all either like a lot of square white girls, you know, who were good singers and stuff, but like Leslie Gore or Sandra Dee and people like that, or you saw really great singers like Darlene Love and people like that, but they were singers. And performance-wise, somebody like Tina Turner, but I couldn't possibly compare myself to someone of her magnitude. I pretty much just liked, you know, I looked at rock performers really as a masculine, you know, I was raised that, you know, all the great rock performers were guys, you know. You know, from, I mean, I loved, you know, Jimi Hendrix, and I liked the Rolling Stones, and Jim Morrison, and Bob Dylan, and people like that. I mean, even somebody like Elvis Presley. I mean, I just like a committed performer.
So did you feel like you were drawing on a masculine part of your own energy?
Well, I didn't think about it, but I can say that most of my influences were male,
mm-hmm.
except for ones that are kind of obscure. Somebody like Lotta Lenya was a big influence.
She was a big influence
on
you? That's interesting.
Yeah.
She was married to Kurt Weill for many years, mm-hmm. a singer born in Germany who specialized in singing Kurt Weill's music and was an extraordinary singer, although...
Well, she was a really great performer, too, if you see her in, like, Pirate Jenny, you know,
mm-hmm.
on Three Penny Opera or
mm-hmm.
something.
Mm-hmm.
She was very inspiring because she was very, you know, she didn't have the greatest voice. She was more a personality voice like Bob Dylan.
Exactly, right. But
so
she understood the meaning of a song so well.
Certainly, just like Bob Dylan.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I was influenced by her, and I listened to a lot of Edith Piaf and, you know, like June Christie or...
Now, June Christie is a cool singer, so unlike you. You're hot.
But that's the kind of singer, you know, I always thought when I grew up I'd sort of sing like that, but it hasn't happened yet.
Like June Christie?
Yeah, I always like June Christie or, you know, singers like that. I always liked Chris Connor.
Yeah.
I love her. She's like my favorite.
No, I'm really still trying to imagine you singing, say, June Christie and Chris Connor kinds of songs, you know, a kind of cool jazz type of feel.
I do around the house, you know.
Really? What kind of songs do you like to sing around the house?
I like Slow Boat to China.
Oh, I love that song.
Well, my mother listened to all that.
It's
my
a great
father,
Frank Lesser song.
Yeah, you know, my dad used to listen to Duke Ellington, and we listened to Stan Kenton, and I've always loved jazz, you know, and so I saw that progression, you know, and my dad sort of stopped at early Miles Davis, but then I kept moving through Coltrane and
mm-hmm.
Albert Eiler and things like that. But
okay, feel free to say no to this, but would you feel like singing a verse of Slow Boat to China?
Oh, geez, I don't know. Well, my voice is kind of, let me see. I'm gonna get you on a slow boat to China, all to myself alone. Something like that.
Oh, yeah. Thank you.
How embarrassing. Now I'm embarrassed, but, you know.
Oh, no, that's wonderful.
Sort of sound like my mother.
You know, what I'd like to ask you about, in 1977, you fell off the stage in Tampa and fractured a couple of vertebrae in your neck and were out of commission for about a year. I always wondered if that was embarrassing to you to fall off the stage.
No, not real. I mean, it was not really because it was a product of, I thought, I've talked about this a lot with Lenny. It was really a product of high commitment and from the part of our band and sort of and a lack of support from the band that I was opening. We were opening up Bob Seger, and they didn't give us much light or much space on the stage, and it was a fairly high stage. And when I asked for a little help, you know, a little more light or a little more, you know, room, not for any egotistical reason, but because I was frightened of the stage, I was ignored. So so I really look at that accident as a product of, you know, their lack of community.
Mm-hmm.
And really the fact that, you know, if I would have, like, just stood there, you know, I tried to just stand there and perform, you know, and not move too much.
Not your style.
Because I really couldn't see the edge of the stage, and right. We had so little room. And we had a lot of people for some reason, even though we were opening, we had a really very verbal following there, and our people were so exciting. It was partially the people's fault. They were, you know, just so full of energy, and we were doing "Ain't It Strange," which was one of our most physical songs. That, you know, I tripped over my monitor, or my monitor was on the lip of the stage, and I went over.
What went through your mind as you started to go over?
I just tried to relax. You know, I just thought, well, this is bad. but I just tried to submit to the situation, and I thought if I submitted, I wouldn't get hurt as much. But it was pretty rough for a while. You know, people said all kinds of things. They said I was totally stoned and fell off the stage, and all of these things are, you know, a total lie. It had nothing to do with that. If I was in any special state, it was more of a, you know, we would really drive ourselves to some kind of fever pitch or spiritual state in that particular song. And as a band, we were in the top of our form.
Do you feel like you're a different person on stage than you were 20 years ago?
Well, if I don't feel like a different person after 20 years, I mean, that would be a sad state of things. I mean, hopefully I've evolved as a human being, and I have, you know, hopefully new things to offer and a range of experience to offer. But there are still certain aspects within myself that I had when I was 8, and I still have them. You know, I mean, we do evolve as human beings, but we also have within us all those different stages that brought us to where we are. So when I'm on stage, you know, you have someone who's like, before the year is over, will be 50 years old, but also sometimes has the energy of a 22-year-old, and sometimes has this, you know, the rebellion of a 14-year-old. So I got it all, I suppose.
We only have a couple of seconds. I want to end with your song "Farewell Reel," and I see this in a way as a song of goodbye and a song of getting on with life, continuing with life in spite of the loss. Would you say just a couple of words about writing this?
Well, I read it. Fred, I wrote the little piece of music after Fred taught me to play guitar, and he actually really liked it. He said I made a nice piece of music, which was encouraging. And the first few lines, it's been a hard time, and when it rains on me. Fred wrote. I didn't even write them. He just wrote them, or he just spoke them just about, I don't know, month or before he died. And I said, I really like those words. And I said, can I have them? And he said, yes. And then when he passed away, I finished the song. And I actually finished it very quietly and very, it just, one night, I sat up all night and wrote it. And wrote it for Fred.
Patti Smith, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
So darling, farewell, I will be well and then I will be fine. The children will rise strong and happy, be sure.
Patti Smith's new CD is called Gone Again. Arista is reissuing her early albums. She also has a new book of short prose pieces dedicated to her longtime friend, the late artist Robert Mapplethorpe. Coming up, TV critic David Bianculli reviews the last work by the TV writer who gave us The Singing Detective. This is Fresh Air. In the spring of 1994, Dennis Potter, the British TV writer who wrote Pennies from Heaven and The Singing Detective, was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer and given only a few months to live. Before his death, he completed scripts for two final miniseries, which were just shown on TV in England, and will be screened throughout the summer in New York and Los Angeles. TV critic David Bianculli has a review.
In Dennis Potter's last TV interview, which he conducted between swigs of liquid morphine to keep the pain down, he described the two projects he was racing to finish before he died. One was called Karaoke, and is about a TV writer who fears that the dialogue and action and people in his scripts are starting to cross over into real life. The other, set 400 years in the future, was called Cold Lazarus, and is about the discovery and reactivation of a cryogenically frozen head, which allows scientists of the 24th century to stimulate and tap into one brain's memories of the almost forgotten 20th century. Potter had both of those dramas in the works before he got cancer, as independent six-part stories commissioned by separate TV networks. When he was given his grim prognosis, he feared he wouldn't live long enough to finish them. So he pared down each miniseries to four parts and began his meticulous process of writing and rewriting. That's when he came upon the inspiration that marries these two projects together. He took Daniel Field, the TV writer who's the central character of Karaoke, and made his head and brain the one that's at the center of Cold Lazarus. He also, in Karaoke, gave Daniel pancreatic cancer. So what Karaoke and Cold Lazarus turn out to be is this: the story of a dying and dead TV writer, written by a dying TV writer who's now dead. After Potter's death, producers Kenneth Trodd and Rosemary Whitman and director Rennie Rye collaborated to bring his final TV works to life. Albert Finney got the doubly central role of Daniel Field, and other key parts went to such actors as Julie Christie, Richard E. Grant, and Diane Ladd. The violence in the stories is tame by U.S. standards, but Karaoke, and especially Cold Lazarus, contains so much nudity and raw language, they may never be televised in the States. So catching a museum show may be your best, if not only, opportunity to see these last two Potter pieces. They're not quite on the level of The Singing Detective, but what else on TV is? What they are fascinating. In Karaoke, Potter explores the central themes of his work, romantic obsession and being a victim of sexual abuse as a child, more truthfully than ever before. He's got a kind of deathbed honesty going, and it's quite powerful. And in Cold Lazarus, while exploring the ideas of art and artists and mortality, Potter also takes time to have a bit of fun, as when he has two scientists debate just what will happen when a futuristic media mogul gets hold of the memories in Daniel Field's thought-out brain.
He gets the right to take the memories of Daniel Field, edit them, and transmit them all over the world, on his TV, his cable, his videos, his VRs, his whole crock of shit. He's convinced that he'll sweep the ratings when people out there see what it was really like to walk and talk and play and nearly 400 years ago.
And maybe, just maybe, he's too smart for his own good. Maybe, maybe. You see, he's right in a way. Now, how stupendous to see the real past through the eyes and the feelings of someone who lived in it. Oh, God, what an escape. Can't you just imagine how avidly people would lap it up? And then, oh, if only, and then they might look at the world around them, the world as it is now, and start to ask questions. Why do we have to live like this? Why cannot we walk in the streets? Why can't we mingle and touch and hope in the way our forefathers and mothers used to? Why?
That may be what constitutes entertainment in the future. But as for the present, Dennis Potter's final TV miniseries will do just fine.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Dennis Potter's last TV dramas, Karaoke and Cold Lazarus, are being shown through the summer at the Museum of Television and Radio in New York and its branch in Los Angeles. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Alan Tu, and Amy Sallet, with Kathy Wolf, Louisa Shafia, and Barbara Bogave. Research assistance from Rena Bander. Our intern is Phoebe Van Skoy. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $15.45 and includes shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the George Gund Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.